The Last Bohemians LA. Unexpected stories from Maverick women.
Welcome to the final episode of our Los Angeles series, supported by Audio Technica. 8 episodes, 8 very different stories, 8 brilliant women taking you from the sleazy Sunset Strip to the glamorous Hollywood Hills. This was the last interview that producer Holly Fisher and I recorded in LA earlier this year with the artist Penny Slinger, and I got pretty emotional towards the end. Something about her outlook on life felt so at odds with my own. I wished I could be as open as her. And though we've covered a lot of important themes in this series, taboos, resilience, creativity, freedom, the part at the end where Penny talks about aging and visibility made me totally crumple. Celebrate women while they're alive. That's what we try to do with this podcast anyway. A huge thank you, as ever, to our partners Audio Technica. They're celebrating 60 years of supplying audiophiles, vinyl lovers, podcast junkies and creators with some seriously superb equipment. High quality and yet accessible for all. If you were looking for a new record deck, they have some super slick and affordable models that will look very cool on your sideboard. Head to audio-technica.com for the full details. Now, to a different part of the city, the Arts District in downtown LA, where we enter the home of the forgotten British surrealist and Los Angeles transplant, Penny Slinger.
Here we are in downtown LA, in the old Federal Reserve building, and it's full of beautiful studios. Instead of looking out onto the concrete jungle, I'm looking at somewhere full of greenery and at the moment fuchsia flowers, bougainvillea. The energy, just, you know, putting your finger to the wind kind of psychically, it felt that LA had a nice burgeoning energy now and was attractive, and so felt like a good place to settle.
For a while, it seemed like Penny Slinger had been forgotten. Another female artist, lost to time, one of the many women making crucial work who'd been left out of the history books. She went to Chelsea Art School during the swinging 60s and, inspired by Max Ernst, went on to mix up self-portrait, collage, film and sculpture to create surreal and feminist images that still provoke today. Among these were her full frontal collages, including ones where Penny appears inside a wedding cake, the slice between her legs removed. Her 1977 collage masterpiece, An Exorcism, meanwhile, evoked the darkness of the English psyche, stitching together ghoulish images of the countryside, genitals, nuns, and manor houses. Truly terrifying. In England, Penny counted the photographer Lee Miller among her friends, and at one point lived in a turret in Soho in London, where her boyfriend, the counterculture filmmaker Pete Whitehead, kept falcons. How's that for bohemian? Penny appeared in experimental films and wrote a number of books on themes of sex and mysticism, eroticism, inner goddesses, and divine femininity, including 1979's Sexual Secrets, The Alchemy of Ecstasy. But after a solo show in New York in 1982, she abandoned the art world, tired of its sexism and narrow-mindedness. She moved first to the Caribbean, then to Northern California, and finally settled in LA. It's only recently that Penny's work has been rediscovered. In 2009, she was included in the Angels of Anarchy art show of female surrealists in Manchester, and she was the subject of a 2017 documentary by Richard Kovach, which is how I first heard about her groundbreaking catalogue. In our final Last Bohemians LA episode, Penny talks about sexual and sensual liberation, finding her voice in a male-dominated art scene, starring in the only feature film directed by a woman in the 1970s, how she hopes to see a retrospective in her lifetime, and how desire doesn't diminish with age.
Thank you.
from the moment that I was at art school, really. I didn't believe for one minute that women were less talented than men. And I remember asking one of my teachers, how is it that I'm looking at the students and a lot of the women are actually doing a lot better than the boys here? Why is it that the boys are coming out and becoming the artists and not the women? They said, well, you know, we do like to encourage the girls, but we find they so often go off and get married and then they don't do it anymore, so it's not really worth it. So I felt that this choice between domestic life and non-domestic life was rather key and important to me, which is why I've never really taken a domestic path in my life, although I've had partnerships. I chose to be much more of a bohemian character and to live my life on the edge and to choose to have my primary relationship in my life with my art. And I've had lots of other relationships which have fed into that, but art has been my one affair, which has continued throughout my whole life. I went to what was Farnham College of Art, and it's now West Surrey, I think, and I did a 2-year diploma course there and then 3 years at Chelsea. And when I got to art school, it was the first time I was happy in my education. I was never happy at school before that. But when I got to art school, I thought, well, now I'm in the right place doing what I love, and here I am, I've arrived. And then when I was at Chelsea, they actually ended up putting me in my own studio under the stairs because I didn't quite fit in. I was wanting to mix all the different media from all the different departments, and printmaking and photography with sculpture, with painting. And so I was an anomaly. It was something that was a little bit challenging. And yet I did get supported and had wonderful members of staff, the young pop artists who were making it on the London scene. And I would also manage to go out to all the private views and just immerse myself in the art culture that I'd been yearning for. We felt that things were possible, and I say we because there was a collective energy in the air. The way that I was coming of age myself was paralleled by the way all the music was coming of age too. The Beatles came out when I was a very young teenager. And then that passage, all the rhythm and blues movement of people throughout the south of England. I used to go every weekend to the concerts, so it was like the soundtrack to my growing up experience. And so again, more of this interweaving between the different media, and I love that.
It was the time of sexual liberation, a newfound supposed freedom for women. How is that feeding into your work?
Oh, I think it was absolutely vital. I mean, the pill came on the market when I was about 16, and so that opened up that freedom for women to choose for themselves and to explore for themselves. And that liberation for women, of course, helped liberate men as well, because here we are now, suddenly there's a lightness. We can play, we can explore.
At the same time, was there also still a repression in a way? There was no pornography for women, for example.
No, well, that's why, you know, one of the challenges I took on for myself, and I put myself a little at odds with a lot of the feminist movement at the time, because that was more politically orientated and wanting the same rights as men, and feeling that if you were dealing with sexuality, you were somehow betraying the cause. But for me, I felt we want the equality, but we want it on our own terms, and we want it owning and being able to have all the richness of who we are, which means our sensuality and our sexuality. I mean, I certainly know growing up that women thought that they didn't really have pleasure in sex. It was like something you do for your husband. So I thought, as I started growing up and having my own experiences, this isn't right. I know this isn't right. And so, as you say, there was no erotica made for women, and it was very unusual for me as a nice girl to put myself naked in publications. And I deliberately put myself in some men's magazines too, and showed my work, showed myself naked with my work, and hoped to get men to look at me because I was attractive, but then read what I had to say and have to think again and realize that this was not an object you were looking at. This was someone who was very much the subject and very much had her own voice and was very much there to kind of break down the paradigms of how she was seen and claim the right to show herself how she wanted to show herself.
And against this backdrop of sexual liberation, was your work still seen as risque?
Oh, yes, because not really many people were doing it. As years have gone by, I've discovered that other women were doing things that other, in other places in similar time periods, but we didn't have the communication that we have now with the web and with everything being opened up and you know what's going on. You didn't. So I felt rather in a vacuum, but I didn't mind because I didn't want to tread the path well trodden. I wanted to be a pioneer and do something new and challenging. I also felt that, you know, if I use myself, I could be much more free and ruthless with how I showed that image and liberties I took with my own self-image. It was a boys' club, and I did look at the history of art and say, oh my goodness, there's hardly any women here. And that was one of the reasons I chose to use myself as my own muse, because I saw throughout the history of art, the woman as muse was just all the way through, but nearly always represented through a male lens. It's him making the image of her. And I thought, well, how about if I make my image of myself? I know myself better than other people do, and I can show more about who I really am rather than how my superficial appearance may be rendered. So that's why I thought it was so important to take that position.
What was your take on surrealism? What were you doing differently?
Well, my take on surrealism was mainly through the discovery when I was researching for my thesis of the collage books of Max Ernst. At the time, I really thought collage was something that you'd see where pieces were stuck together. And then in the collage books, Saman de Bonte, La Femme sans tête, Ernst created these seamless worlds from these old engravings. So you couldn't see where anything was stuck together. You just saw this new magical world of dreams that he had created. And when I saw that, I said, yes, that's what I want. But I want to, my piece, I don't want to emulate this. I want to use the inspiration this is giving me to create something of my own. And what I saw as a gap in the history of art and also spilling into surrealism, although there were female surreal artists, I didn't see that anyone had really used the tools of surrealism to explore the psyche and the inner world of the feminine. So Roland Penrose, who I met to talk to about Max Ernst, was one of the only people in England who really knew about surrealism at that time. And he had been friends with the surrealists. He painted himself. He was married to Lee Miller, who was the muse of Man Ray and a photographer in her own right, obviously, as we're seeing more and more these days. But so he was in the heart of that culture. And that was rare to find in England. And he was also president of the Institute of Contemporary Arts. So for him to not only assist me with the thesis, but then to recognize the quality and value of my art in the tradition of the surrealists was an amazing boon. And he did become for a few years a patron for me in the true archetypal sense of the word.
And what was hanging out at Farley Farm like with Roland and Lee?
Oh, that was amazing. I went a number of weekends. I would go down there. And of course, the whole property is full of beautiful art from all of the surrealists housed in this amazing farmhouse in the middle of the country. And apparently a very specially located, his son Anthony said, located on ley lines. So it had a lot of magic to it too. And then Lee at that time was making these feasts. She had turned her creative energy into being a hostess who would create these meals for people. And then every weekend there would be a group of people collected. It wasn't just me, but other interesting people. And I met met Valentine too, Roland's first wife, who was a writer, poetess, artist, who was a very beautiful woman who I had a deep connection with. So many of these things happened through that association with Roland.
Did you identify with Lee Miller's career? Do you see parallels between your career and Lee Miller's career?
I didn't so much at the time. I really didn't know so much about Lee's career. I really knew her mainly as the muse of Man Ray and how beautiful she was when she was young. And it really wasn't until years later that I found out more about her photographic career. But that's been true too about a lot of the women surrealists. I didn't have as much knowledge of the female surrealists has become available now. And I think we really knew much more about the male artists.
Who was Peter Whitehead?
Peter was this incredibly talented young filmmaker who I met. I had left from Chelsea. I was actually living with Michael Cousteau, who was running the ICA at that point. And Michael said one day, there's a young filmmaker coming round, can you make him at home because I'm going out? And then Peter came round and Peter just started talking about his ideas for film, and he spoke my language in the way that I hadn't heard anyone else do, really, quite like that. And he was so handsome. And I remember he drove me home afterwards to my other place that I'd been, when I had to go and pick up some things. And when we got there, he put his hand on my shoulder and I said, oh, hell, because I knew that we were meant to be together, and he knew it too.
So you moved in with him?
I did, practically immediately after, and we went off on a wild adventure to France, and after that to Morocco, and then we went to Lilford Hall, that mansion house in the country where he'd stayed when he was a student, and we went to find it again, found it, and then got permission to film there, and we were going to make this big film together, which never really materialized like that. We did film, and that became, with my girlfriend Sue, we three of us filmed there, and that became this Lilford Hall film, which I've shown just really as the rushes as they came out of the camera. And then I took a whole series of photographs with him of the whole place, and that became the basis for An Exorcism, which I worked on for many years after we split up. I don't know why we couldn't really work together in the way we thought. It somehow to do with not knowing who was in control. It was one of those things. He was a very strong force. I was a very strong force. We both had strong mythologies we brought with us, and somehow it just stayed nebulous and it couldn't get focused into who was actually directing. He liked to be very much on his own, and he ended up taking up falconry, which he'd had a dream about for a long time when we were together, and we moved into a beautiful house in the countryside called Duck Lake. I had my own bird called Knut, and I trained that bird, and we had also a kestrel and an owl living in the kitchen who were rescued birds, and so they actually lived in the rafters of the big kitchen. And he had his falcons, and he would go off into his wing of his house and write, and I would be in the kitchen making all my objects, which were the pieces that went into my first solo exhibition at Angela Flowers Gallery in 1971. So we were there together, but living a little bit our separate artistic lives, even though cohabiting. Of course, I myself in my life have been very drawn to powerful men, and when you have a powerful man, you often have a powerful ego to contend with, so you have to battle not only to survive but also to claim your own position in that, and that sometimes takes a while. I feel I've been a survivor of some of those relationships, and if I wasn't as strong as I was, I probably wouldn't have come out intact on the other side.
So you and Peter never ended up making your film together, but you did star in a couple of films. Can you tell us about the film The Other Side of the Underneath?
Well, this was with Jane Arden, and Jane Arden started off this first all-women's theatre group called Holocaust, which I myself and two other women who were friends of mine were part of.
That's a bit of an extreme name.
Yes. Well, Jane was rather extreme. And we did this theatre production called New Communion for Freaks, Prophets and Witches, which we put on at the Open Space in London and at the Edinburgh Film Festival.
Were you a freak, a prophet or a witch?
I guess all of them. We did these workshops and dredged up from our subconscious all the things that we felt were repressed and our relationships to mummy and daddy and all this stuff. And then crystallize those things into this form of a theatrical presentation, which was done in very much of a cabaret style. So there was a lightness of touch to that, which allowed all this rather heavy stuff to be put forward in quite an agreeable way. And then we went on to make this film, The Other Side of the Underneath. But that film, which we went to Wales to do and live together, that was a lot heavier, and it became more of Jane's story. She was brought up in Wales. We went back to the places she'd come from, and it was pretty traumatic, and everybody came out pretty scarred at the end of that. And it was that experience and me staying in and doing that that actually was the wedge that then made Peter and I split up.
The making of this film sounds a bit like The Wicker Man, to be honest.
Right, it was a bit intense.
I've seen stills from your documentary of it, or scenes from it, and there's someone's on a crucifix,
right.
Naked.
Right.
There seems to be a lot of psychological, traumatic stuff going on. But there was also a sex scene.
Yes. Jane asked me to do this sex scene with her partner, Jack Bond, and I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back with Peter, because I didn't want to do anything behind his back, so I called him before and said, I'm going to be doing this, and he said, no, don't come back. I said, no, I've got to stay through and complete this work that I'm doing. But he couldn't forgive me for making that decision, and that's really what broke us apart, because he didn't really think Jane was doing good things. He didn't like how she was manipulating people, and then the fact that I made that decision, he couldn't stomach it. I mean, I knew I'd never be a porn star, that's for sure.
Did you actually do it?
I did, but then how I got through it is I ended up feeling very sorry for Jack at a certain point. I realised that he was scared stiff, and so I kind of did it so that he wouldn't feel emasculated as a man.
That sounds very familiar. Did this film get shown? Did it get screened?
It did, and it was the only feature film in the 70s that a woman directed it. It's just that the promise of what we were going to do as a group of women didn't really come through, and the whole experience was so traumatic, and I think Jane herself couldn't really hold it all together, and she was pretty shattered from it.
One of the most shocking things about the outcome of that film was what happened to the cellist who was doing the soundtrack.
Right. No, it was the cellist's boyfriend, Martin. Her husband, in fact, and they had a little girl, and he set fire to himself in Holland Park afterwards as a protest for what he saw to be the black magic of the film. So it was that intense and strong. And so afterwards, we all kind of broke up and left everyone devastated. And that's another reason why I needed to do this work called An Exorcism, because it needed to have a redemption, and the film didn't have really a redemptive quality. It left you with trauma, and that, to me, wasn't good enough. And so I had to work through all that and do my own series, which I put together as An Exorcism, where there was a death and a rebirth at the end. I was trying to get rid of the psychological demons by opening up to the skeletons in the cupboard, so laying all that bare so that you can bring them to the light of day and deal with them, not so that you can then become them. It's so that you can identify them, so you can free yourself from them. Because when you live in fear of the shadow is always going to haunt you, and you're never really going to be able to be free and in the light. We took all these photographs of the empty derelict mansion house, Lilford Hall, which was so beautiful and evocative in their own right. And I've always loved ancient buildings and the majesty of them, but especially in a derelict state like that, and the idea of the secret garden and the secret door that leads to these unknown passages that you can go through and explore and discover something of mystery and wonder that is not just to do with the mundane world. So this building held all that evocative sense, and the spirits seemed to be in there lingering everywhere. So I thought, this is an amazing stage set through which I can, once I decided that I wanted to embark on this work of self-discovery, that it was a good set in which I could bring my players and have all these different rooms represent all the different aspects of myself, all the different parts of the psyche that I wanted to explore.
And what did you learn about yourself in your early career, putting yourself as the muse and doing pieces such as this?
I've always had a very open access to my imagination and to fantasy and to the mind sky and to visions. It allows you to be another practice which I've adopted all my life, be subject and object at the same time, and to view yourself with a certain kind of objectivity, which allows me to look at myself as a piece of art rather than as my ego self. So I like to explore all the multi-fractured nature of self, multifaceted views. So, you know, I could be a bird woman at one time, I can be a lioness at another. I can have that range of being that I feel we are often limited in the avenues that social structures and culture give us, and being, you know, confined to being in certain roles and taking jobs and being tied into making money or making families, that we don't get to really be able to explore just how multidimensional we really are and how magical as beings we are, and to allow mundane reality to become much more of a mythic landscape that we are traversing in this walk of life.
Could we all do with a little bit more magic in our lives?
I think so, yes, definitely. The choices that I made in my life and the path that I followed were very much dictated by my spiritual callings and feeling like I was following the path of my heart and spirit. When I discovered that there was a spiritual path I could choose that didn't exclude my sexuality but included it, was something that I felt was so healthy and refreshing that everybody needed to be able to understand that they didn't have to make the choice between flesh and spirit. They could find something that encompassed at all. And I think actually that's the path of the feminine now, that bringing flesh and spirit as one, that we see everything as sacred. That has been, you know, a substratum of all my work and life ever since.
So that's interesting, because it seems that your work was very concerned with the self, this idea of you as muse, and then did something change?
Well, it was really after I'd done an exorcism, and when I'd been through that kind of death and rebirth cycle and came out of that, it's, well, what's next? And that's when I was able to luckily find and explore the whole realm of Tantra, not as what a lot of people understand it to just be the religion of sex. It's so much more than that. It means to weave and to expand. So it's a path that weaves together all the threads of who you are and allows you to expand into a more multidimensional view of the self. So once I found that, that's what shifted me away from psychology into more transpersonal, if you like, into seeing, well, what are the divine feminine archetypes? What are the things we can aspire to and hold within ourselves?
How did you discover Tantra?
I went to an exhibition at the Hayward Gallery in, I think it was 1971, 1972. And when I walked in and looked at the art, I had one of those aha moments when I just felt, I know this. And then I took it upon myself to try and find the way to do that, and did find a partner a few years later who was really deeply immersed in the culture and the art and the spiritual path, and could bring to me all those teachings that I was yearning for. And then when we got together, that's when we produced a number of things, Sexual Secrets being one of them, Secret Dakini Oracle being the oracle deck we did on the Tantric Philosophy, and Mountain Ecstasy, which was the collage book, my third collage book, about celebrating the joy of the mountains and the technicolor wonder world that I discovered once I got rid of all the guilt and shame and taboos.
Well, I really want to talk about the guilt and shame and taboos. Did you encounter, when you were creating those books and going on this journey, that there was resistance to what you were doing?
Certainly in the UK at that time, there wasn't a really receptive audience for that. And I don't know if you've noticed, but Brits tend to really take the piss out of spiritual things. That's like part of the culture and philosophy. So that I didn't fail to notice that. And I also felt that the expansion that it was really allowing me to feel wasn't really understood by people in general. They more wanted to whittle it down and diminish it to being just about sex, for instance. I remember my exhibition I had in 77 in London, and I had work from an exorcism. I had my dollhouses. I had work from all the new Tantra series. And someone wrote in the visitor's book, congratulations on being the first woman to have vagina envy. So, you know, the reductionist way of looking at things. And so I was, when I did leave from England and went to New York to work on the book, and then had an exhibition in New York in the early 80s, a big retrospective, and again, didn't feel that, although I'd expected New York to be more sophisticated, didn't feel the climate was really ready to understand.
What kind of work are you making now? What themes are you drawn to?
I've been working on a project for the last few years called My Body. And it's about my body of experience, expressing it now at this time in my life at age 74 through my own naked body again, using myself as a muse, because I feel very strongly that it's the next bastion of feminism, ageism. And that if we don't get the wisdom of our elders, particularly our older sisters, being able to percolate back into society, this is one of the reasons that we're not really evolving in the way that we could and I feel need to. And so that wisdom of accumulated experience is super important to be able to be accessed. And we get marginalized and being invisible again when we get older as women, whether they're not young, hot, magnetic, sexy beings. And so I've taken it on myself to use myself as my muse again in the work, so that I can try and make myself visible again. It's still a work in progress.
How has your relationship with your body changed as you've got older?
I feel my body is basically the kind of the same. It's just got a bit older and have to deal with a few more aches and pains, a few more arthritic bumps, all of this kind of thing. But I'm still me, and that I feel is again an important part that I want to try and express through using myself at this time, which is not generally accepted practice, but I feel it's really important and relevant. And I don't want to be the invisible woman again now. I want to be visible, and I want my voice to be heard. And that voice, again, is a mouthpiece for all those unheard voices of the elders which come into their latter years and don't have a platform, don't have a channel through which to express everything that they could express and share if given the opportunity.
It's really interesting, specifically on the sort of topic of desire, female desire and aging. Those are two topics that society just really doesn't want to hear about. Mm. Do you remember the moment when you felt your sexual power changing?
I guess just whenever I would come into a room, I knew people would look at me. And then suddenly I'd come into a room and no one even noticed. And then I'd say, oh God, I don't like this. And then I realized that the only way I could get noticed again was on the power of my being, myself, which was not just then dictated by how I superficially looked, whether I had the right clothes, the right makeup, you know, and that kind of glamour, but looking beyond the glamour to what is intrinsic character and quality and power of being. So I've been cultivating that to bring it out into the world because, as I say, I want to break this invisibility spell.
And do you still talk about sex with your friends in the same way?
Oh, when you're a young woman, you talk about sex in a different way from when you get older. I guess people more come to me too, as I have a lot of people, especially younger women that I see, they probably come to me and ask me things as a point of reference rather than me sharing what my latest experience was anymore.
But that's still something that seems so taboo. It's sexual desire doesn't diminish just because you get older. Do you still feel strong sexual desire?
Yes, I can still feel things. I have dreams, you know, I have all these things that mean that you're still fully operational as a sensual being. But I think once you understand, and through my embracing of Tantra too, understanding that it's not just what we can say organ-specific, the one sexuality and sensuality, is more about a whole way of approaching life and the world and being open and sensitive and charged so that, you know, rain falling on you can feel like an ecstatic experience. These kind of things, touching, smelling a flower, our antennas shouldn't be atrophied and desensualized. We need to re-sensualize our whole beings, not just our organ-centric sensuality, but our full-blown, full-body, full-auric sensuality.
If anyone's listening to this podcast and they're wondering how to get in touch with that sense of sensuality and desire, what's the one thing that you would tell people to go and do?
Carpe every diem. I mean, really embrace life fully and open your heart. You know, we armor our hearts, we close ourselves off because of the rough, tough life that we experience. And that may be a way of getting through and not getting so wounded. But once we do that, we're losing a big part of ourselves. And really, it's that opening up one's sensibility, which is heart-centric, not intellect-centric, which will allow us to just be reconnected to everything. Don't shut yourself down. Learn to open yourself more and more. Because the more open you are to life, the more life will be a celebration of every moment and every breath that you breathe.
You could have been as big and well-known as Judy Chicago, for example, or maybe even Frida Kahlo, who knows? But is that what you've held on to? Have you relinquished any feeling of annoyance about that?
Oh, no, I still think that I'm meant to be a big, important figure in the history of art. And what I'm trying to kind of deal with at the moment is I would like some of that to happen while I'm alive rather than after I'm dead. I mean, look at Frida, for instance. You say, oh, she's so big, but look what she got in her life. She had like one or two exhibitions. She was totally in the shadow of Diego. She hardly got any satisfaction of that. And that has been the pattern, not just for women, but for a lot of important male artists too. So I'm working as hard as I can while I'm alive. And my dream is to have a big exhibition somewhere where I can show all the facets of my rich life in all these different rooms, so that not only I will be able to have that aha moment of all the dots of light suddenly turning on, but others could have it too, because I think it will enrich them as well.
Las Bohemians LA. Unexpected stories from Maverick women.
You've been listening to The Last Bohemians LA, hosted by me, Kate Hutchinson. This episode was produced by Holly Fisher and supported by Audio Technica. Thank you to all of our incredible Bohemians this season. Linda Ramone, Penny Slinger, Johanna Wendt, Angeline, Lynn Castle, Gloria Hendry, Michelle Lamy, and Betty Saar, Alison Saar, and Maddie Lisa. Really hope that you've enjoyed listening to it as much as we've enjoyed making it. We love being your favourite cult niche podcast, but if you do fancy leaving us a review or tweeting about us or doing an Instagram post, it really helps get the word out there so that more people can find out about what we're doing here. Who knows whether there'll be a new series, but I do hope so. And I do have some special bonus episodes lined up for you. So do, as they say, stay tuned, and I'll be dropping those over the next couple of months. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.